This is the Sandman Podcast on TV Podcast Industries. We're back discussing The Dead Boy Detectives, Episode 4, The Case of the Lighthouse Leapers, and Episode 5, The Case of the Two Dead Dragons.
This could be your soulmate.
Okay, Nico, pretty massive leap from anonymous letters to love.
Maybe, but you're keeping them for a reason, right? I mean, if there was a way that you could just find out who was sending them, would you want to?
No. No. The letters are nice. They make me feel nice, okay? But also, they're all typed, which is creepy serial killer territory. They might as well be written with letters cut out of magazines. Besides, no one ever turns out to be who you think they are. And it's disappointing.
No, I get that. I've been thinking about some old memories, and I'm starting to realize that I don't even know who I am. But I might even be a worse person than I thought.
This sweet moment got really heavy.
Screw the past. You can be anybody you want. Hell, maybe you can even be somebody with a bank account.
Where are the dead boy detectives?
Welcome back, fellow dreamers, to TV Podcast Industries, chatting about the Dead Boy Detectives. Two more episodes this week. I'm one of your hosts, Derek.
Hello there, fellow dreamers. I am one of your other hosts, John. Yes, we're on to episode 4 and 5 of the Dead Boy Detectives.
Yep, yeah, two more cases in the books.
Yes, yeah. Lighthouse Leapers and Two Dead Dragons.
Yeah. Were you expecting real dragons? I thought we were in this fantasy world where we get to see dragons.
I did kind of think that, but I like the little subterfuge.
Yeah. Yeah.
The title.
All good. We are going to go into spoiler-filled detail on these episodes. So if you're watching along with us, make sure you watch both episode 4 and episode 5. And we are going to separate them slightly in the episode. But just in case we spoil anything for you, make sure you've watched the episodes. And we would love if you'd subscribe to our main podcast feed. Go over to tvpodcastindustries.com. Loads of options over there for you to subscribe on every podcast catcher around. And if you want to subscribe there. And we'd also love to hear your thoughts on Dead Boy Detectives. You can email us to feedback@tvpodcastindustries.com with your thoughts. Or popping over to our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/TV Podcast Industries to leave your thoughts on one of the spoiler posts that I put up when the episodes were released on day one.
Yes, let us get into our spoiler-filled discussion. Let's crack on. Derek, who gave us what, where, when, and how for episode 4. The Case of the Lighthouse Leapers.
Well, The Dead Boy Detectives, of course, is based on characters created by Neil Gaiman and Matt Wagner. It was created for TV by Steve Yockey. He's also the co-showrunner alongside Beth Schwartz. The executive producer on this show, of course, is Greg Berlanti, who's well known for his work on the DC Arrowverse. Episode 4 was written by Joshua Conkle and Kristen Lane Tucker. Kristen was a writer on The Flight Attendant and The Black Lady Sketch Show. And Joshua was a writer on The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Good stuff.
Yeah, lots of people coming over from the DC Arrowverse with Greg Berlanti, I think, who've worked on many of those shows.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You can see his fingerprints on this.
A little bit.
A little bit,
yeah. Not as much as on the DC Universe,
no,
thankfully.
Absolutely.
kind of ran out of steam after time. There were great shows, of course, as we've mentioned before. We did like a lot of the shows, but over time they kind of ran out of a bit of steam.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I really liked the Arrowverse to begin with, and then I just kind of faded away from it.
Exactly.
So it was more, it just didn't keep me coming back for the length of time that it was on.
Yeah, 22 episodes, like 8 seasons. It's quite a lot to carry on, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It is a lot, yeah.
But the director of this episode was Andy Armaganian. They directed 2 episodes of Star Trek Discovery as well, and also worked on lots of Arrowverse shows, including Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, and Stargirl.
Excellent stuff. Yeah.
John, do you want to give the Netflix synopsis for episode 4, The Case of the Lighthouse Leapers?
Sure. The team investigates a disturbing series of deaths at a lighthouse, while Crystal hears a voice as she pieces together the clues to this seaside mystery.
Hmm. An interesting episode overall, this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I kind of enjoyed this episode, and it also provided some good backstory for Charles, as well as having the night nurse on the scene.
Absolutely.
Who is glorious. Almost a bit like the child catcher in this episode. was telling the two girls that she didn't really like their swordplay.
Absolutely.
That was really funny, wasn't it?
Yeah, I really liked that scene. Let's get into the top moments from the episode. As we have been doing on the previous episodes, we are taking the titles for our points from the episode titles that come up. And then we'll talk about everything around that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the first one that we have is the Lighthouse Leapers itself, the actual case for this week, which starts out with a grizzled sea dog.
Lighthouse Keeper. Yeah. Dagfin. Mm-hmm. I think what I really liked about this was because it's actually the prelude to him arriving to request the services of the Dead Boy Detectives is Jenny receiving rent, which Jenny wants Crystal to be more like Nico, who gives her a check at least, whereas Crystal gives Jenny a jar of coins.
Yes.
So the ones
they got from last week's case.
I kind of really like this. But we also do find out a bit here that Jenny is getting secret romantic love letters from a secret admirer. And a little bit around that, you know, that it's typed, and Jenny is a bit reluctant following through to try and find out who this actually is, because no one ever turns out who they're supposed to be, according to Jenny.
Yeah.
There's also just the general weirdness of Jenny sort of questioning, well, shouldn't you be in school, all this kind of stuff. And it turns up with Dagfin bursting into the butcher's shop. Of course, Jenny can't see her. So Nico and Crystal both sort of jump in surprise, letting out noise, and Jenny's like, what is going on with you two?
Exactly.
So I kind of really like that dynamic with Jenny. I mean, she is a great foil for everything else going on. You know, she can't see any of this stuff. So for her, she's just got really two weird borders.
Exactly.
You know, Nico possibly less so, because at least she gives the rent in a check.
A little, but I think just in general, from Jenny's point of view, a person like Nico being all into butterflies and flowers and being all happy and being really colourful in comparison to Jenny's a bit more goth-like, dour outlook on life. You know, you mentioned that she gives Jenny a check, but she doesn't just give her a check. She gives her a check with loads of pictures drawn all over it and saying, thank you so much for taking care of me. Yeah. And then she just gets passed over the jar of coins from Crystal, who tells her she can buy loads of wishes with it if that's what she wants to do, you know, which I just thought was really good. But the actual case itself that's brought by Dagfin is that he's been haunting a lighthouse, the only lighthouse in town for the last number of years, and suddenly he's getting lots of interlopers, these people who are coming and killing themselves and then hanging around smiling all the time.
It seems like he's a ghost that likes his own space, and there's suddenly loads of ghosts sort of just arriving and building up here, because there's people just showing up and throwing themselves off the top of the lighthouse or the cliffs close by.
Yeah.
And he's like, I need my own space here.
Exactly.
And it's starting to sort of get crowded out here in the lighthouse.
Yeah.
And it's my space. So he's wanting to get Charles Edwin to investigate these mortals killing themselves and effectively crowding him out.
Yeah. Cramping his style.
And cramping his style. And in return, the payment that he can offer is saltwater taffy, along with a cursed eight ball, which does seem to pique the interest of Edwin, who says that they don't have anything like that in their collection.
Yeah, what does he say? That if it tells people the exact date and time that they'll die? Is that that's what he's saying? But it is an interesting one. You know, we had the conversation last week with Crystal. The reason why they chose the case of the Devil in House was because it comes with payment and she needs to pay rent. She's a human. She's trying to pay rent in Jenny's butcher shop. But the guys don't need money, right?
No.
So I guess this is a little bit of a window into the way they would have worked in the past. They kind of pick up magical objects, I guess, is part of our occult objects to, I guess, put into Charles's bag, which they carry around with them that they could use in future. So I wonder how the Magic 8-Ball will play in the future.
Yeah, and interestingly, as you know, Charles, Edwin and Crystal are joined by Nico on this investigation as they head out to the lighthouse that is starting to get a number of new residents here that Dagfinn is totally against. And we actually see a leaper here immediately, a lady in a dressing gown. And there's at least three that we see here. And actually, it's almost like a siren call. So there's a little bit of a red herring, dare I say it here, in that, you know, you immediately think of sirens on the rocks. You know, it's a very well-known story, sort of luring sailors onto the rocks and to their death. So there's that kind of feeling to this, because they're hearing voices. So of the three, the lady that they see jumping off the lighthouse, she had heard her boyfriend, her ex-boyfriend, and the others had heard the voices of their former, of their dead wife and their father that had passed away. But it was the best feeling, this kind of feeling of being drawn to it. So very siren-esque in that sense. It kind of kicks off in that way, this investigation.
And we have Crystal also gets a voice in her head while she's doing the investigation with Charles. The team kind of split up and go in different directions, and Charles and her are exploring the lighthouse itself, and she gets a voice that she knows is her mother's voice and almost draws her to her death until Charles stops her. Effectively, so
he kind of just he doesn't really know that he's stopping her. He just snaps her out of it by saying, "Are you coming?" As they make their way back down the lighthouse. We have Charles and Crystal off investigating these ghosts. Nika goes to inquire with Asher, the gift shop owner. And Edwin actually is secretly going off to meet the Cat King. There's a cat that comes and gives him a quick scratch, but Edwin thinks that he might be able to give an answer to the question of how many cats are in the town. But 142 is the wrong answer.
Absolutely, yeah, way off. I think you'd probably count 142 on that first night that we're with.
But the bracelet remains on him. But we have this great interaction just with the Cat King.
Sexy
Cat King, you know, uptight people like you, referring to Edwin, he says, you like a bit of rough, but I'm not the Dazzy type here, you know. And you like a bit of role play, you know, what is it that you are actually wanting or seeking here? What is it? And he, you know, he turns into Monty, but he also turns into Charles. But we see that the Cat King is really intrigued by Edwin. You know, he says, I like your secret parts. You know, he likes the secrecy around Edwin, and he's intrigued to find out more and more about it.
He is. And we find an extra power that the Cat King has. He's able to compel someone to tell the truth by a little spell he puts on the lips of Edwin. So we learn that the actual reason why Edwin is running the Dead Boy Detectives isn't just to solve other people's cases. It is for his own benefit, which is to avoid hell. He'll have some good things, I guess, in his ledger if he ever goes back to hell, to prove that he was trying to save and help other people.
Yeah, so he's looking for leniency that maybe either it would spare him hell altogether or the worst parts of hell. He might go somewhere in hell that's a little bit nicer, relatively speaking.
Exactly.
So I like this. And I like the secrecy around that. And again, it projects itself from Edwin, though, this tension that the others can kind of pick up on as well. So
He doesn't want to admit it. So that's what I find interesting about this. He has to be compelled to tell it by this spell, effectively, that the Cat King puts on. He doesn't want to tell other people the reason why he's doing this is for personal gain, because he feels that that would be a really bad admission to everybody else. So I think that's quite interesting, because Charles and Edwin have talked about the fact they want to save other people that had been treated like them. That's the motivation to do it. People that were that had died and nobody had investigated their murders, Edwin and Charles, but that's not actually Edwin's reasoning behind it. His push behind it is to effectively, hopefully, save himself from being in hell again.
But we, I think, moving on to our other point, dangerous women, because with Nico inquiring with Asher, she has a number of pictures in her gift shop at the lighthouse here. One of Lilith, which we know has a connection with Esther.
The witch, yes.
The witch. But also there are the mermaids, kind of sirens, but also a local legend known as the Washerwoman as well, which, so all these different women that are sort of clustering these legends, these mystical, magical, supernatural legends in and around the town and this lighthouse mm-hmm. as well.
Almost like it's a Hellmouth or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Buffy reference there.
You know? Yep. So I kind of, you know, a little bit more, certainly the Lilith piece, because mm-hmm. we know that's connected with Esther. And I just wonder whether more will come out around mm-hmm. that. Yeah. But the more important one is around the Washerwomen. Not that she's dangerous, but they do come across the Washerwoman as well. But it's after, again, we have Crystal, hearing the voice and heads towards the cliffs where the other three ghosts are kind of located looking out to sea.
Yeah.
And she's pulled back by Nico and Charles, but Edwin does see this light in the sea below
mm-hmm.
at the base of the cliffs, which then disappears.
Yeah.
And so they go down to sort of look a little closer at the shoreline where then you get, so again, you know, there's a lot of unsaid things here between Charles and Edwin.
Mm-hmm.
And Crystal is wanting Charles to sort of open up more about his father. And Charles really doesn't want to do that, you know, pushing back on that. And we see Edwin sort of getting drawn into Charles after mm-hmm. his conversations with the Cat King. And we have, you know, Nico being quite perceptive here, is asking him about Monty. And, you know, Edwin's personal struggle here, you just see it on his face.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, she's asking, well, do you want to kiss Monty?
Uh-huh.
You know, this, so I like how all this sort of build up towards then, Edwin effectively calls the Washerwoman a bit of sea glass. That Nico has been collecting.
Yeah, that is an interesting part of it, but I think the actual questioning of Edwin and what he's kind of realizing about the people around him is really fundamental to this episode. The case itself obviously is the mechanism of the episode, but him questioning whether, firstly, he's never admitted to himself that he's gay. We heard in the last episode he was going, but he's a boy and I'm a boy. And Nico was trying to encourage him, going, but that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. The Cat King tempting him with Monty and tempting him with Charles. And then here, the conversation between the two, there's the onset part of it. She asks whether he wants to kiss Monty. And he kind of goes, I don't know, is his response to that. Because I think he is questioning whether it's Monty or whether it's Charles that he's
absolutely
attracted to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, you seem drawn to Charles in the distance as Nico's speaking.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I kind of like the unspoken feelings that Edwin is having.
Yeah.
I think it comes really nicely across his face, mm-hmm. you know, the questioning, the desire a bit.
Yeah.
And I think certainly coming from the Cat King, that is in a sense awakening this
exactly
in Edwin. So it's really good. But we do have then the Washerwoman come here, this local lore, and a local saying that we see on one of the paintings in Asher's gift shop, mm-hmm. which comes through as they look through a red piece of sea glass. And I thought the effect on this was really, really good. Almost like a kaleidoscope, mm-hmm. a fractal type image. But this Washerwoman can see the future. She's kind of washing blood out of garments. And she speaks of creatures in the sea that need to feed. And it's a sea monster, but it must play until it tires. So all these sort of little snippets of information kind of come out from the Washerwoman around this mystery that's happening at the lighthouse.
Yeah, but what she does is she comes and helps people who are in need of help to kind of offset, I suppose, the death that has been caused over the hundreds of years that she's been in town. Yeah, that's the kind of, that's the myth. So she deals with the group separately. She deals with the Dead Boy Detectives and their case of the lighthouse leapers and gives them a bit of help, pointing them towards the ocean. But she separately deals with Crystal because she knows Crystal has a different need and basically gives her a riddle that Crystal finds really difficult to solve about her past and her parents.
Yes, yeah. She says, when the ground moves and the bird cries, stop looking without and start looking within.
Mm-hmm.
It's all very cryptic.
Yes.
And Crystal, not very sure of it, but is immediately whisked out of there. And she,
yeah.
In fact, this message from the washerwoman to Crystal is... she's there on her own.
Yeah.
The other three have already kind of whisked away after the first lot of information around the mystery. So she's kind of, again, left with more questions, really. And I think that's the really great thing about these three. And even with Nico, Nika has her own kind of questions around her own life and the people in it, like her mum and dad. But Crystal, Charles, Edmund, you know, they have these different things that they find difficult to kind of understand or open up about. And I think Crystal is the most open to that. You know, she's quite open about wanting to find more about her mother, you know?
Yeah, exactly. One more dangerous woman in this point, which is the night nurse herself, as she arrives in town. Mentioned earlier on, I just really like that as she arrives, she sees the two girls playing swords and tells them that they're absolutely terrible about it. There'll be blood pouring out of the mouth. You have to act properly. Absolutely disappointed in the two girls. And then she goes to find Jenny, who will hopefully lead her to the dead boy detectives. So I like how quickly she dispenses of the pleasantries and just basically takes over Jenny's mind to find out where they are. I thought that was quite an interesting use of her powers, because she's on a mission now. She's been able to get this trip to Port Townsend to get the dead boy detectives who she's been looking for, and she's not willing to let anybody stand in her way.
No, not at all.
So she is another dangerous woman in this town.
Yeah, I like this, you know, Jenny kind of wondering who's up there and then sort of almost being suffocated as the information is being expedited from Jenny by the night nurse. And she's like, and breathe again. And then she's vanished.
Yeah.
And Jenny almost maybe a little bit of a memory wipe. She's like, going, well, what am I doing up here?
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Another dangerous woman here.
Yeah. Let's move on to our third point from the episode, bait, because the guys go on down to Tragic Mix shop once again to help them out, the local magic shop, to help them out trying to find an implement that might help them dealing with this thing in the ocean.
To try and tire out the sea creature to stop the monster. And Mick immediately goes, well, you're looking for Andrew, and shows this picture of one of the, it's like a huge anglerfish with the illuminescent sort of bulb at the front that attracts the fish's prey, which is what Edwin had seen in the sea below the cliff.
So it seems like because it's so close to the lighthouse and so close to the shore, it's now attracting humans in the same way that it would at the sea. It's attracting the prey. So it's, they're almost prey again of this anglerfish Angie. Yeah.
But I kind of like how Mick here sort of interjects, say, well, don't kill Angie. Mm-hmm. You know, just put her back to sleep because he is... You know, he knows about Angie and ultimately thinks that it's not her fault. In a sense, it's just the fish's time to feed.
Exactly. But
she needs that sustenance like anyone, I guess. Yeah. So she's feeding off humans. But really is, you know, says don't kill her. He's also kind of very intrigued that they have found and seen the washerwoman as well, because he has also been looking for her for many years, so that she can tell how he becomes a walrus again.
How he can go back to being a walrus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And for the second time now, he mentions his story and everybody ignores him because they're on the case. They don't want to hear their story right now. I think his story is going to be pretty interesting.
I think so.
Yeah, he became a human from a walrus. I want to find out what that's all about.
Absolutely.
But again, that's his perspective. He's come from the ocean, so he doesn't want to see the death of Angie. But they do find a magical item that plays music that they're hoping will draw Angie away or tire her out and send her back into the pits of the ocean, I guess, away from the land. There's also just one other note that's in here in the section on around base where they're all hanging around in Jenny's butcher shop. I just like it because Jenny looks at them all and just goes, this isn't the peach pit, get out of here. just in case you don't know, Jenny obviously is a bit older than the rest of the characters here. The Peach Pit was the hangout place in Beverly Hills 90210. So that would have been speaking to Jenny's youth. But all these kids who are teenagers right now are looking at her going, we have no idea what this woman's talking about.
Absolutely.
But and she's trying to kick them out because the butcher shop is not a hangout for them.
No, but they're looking for bait. And I like the little conversation from Nico saying, well, we need pork because, you know, humans are called long pig in terms of from cannibals that would have eaten humans in the past. But we also have Monty arriving as well, looking for Edwin.
Yeah.
And Jenny's just kind of like, and who's this new teenager, you know, that's arrived? But ultimately they go looking for meat scraps from the bin as Monty and Edwin chat. Yeah. And effectively Monty is asking Edwin on a date to go out for coffee.
More bait.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the bait to try and get Edwin on behalf of the witch. Yeah.
So more bait, but he's like, well, I can't drink coffee, but maybe we can go for a walk. Exactly. So a walking date,
yes,
at some point.
Yeah, I think he says something to Edwin about saying that since he woke up, he's been feeling freer and freer meeting up with Edwin. So it feels like Monty might be on his own mission with Edwin.
I think so, yeah.
I feel like he's kind of actually falling for him.
Maybe
yeah. I'm falling for the base too.
Yeah, whether Esther's plan is fully formed. I mean, I guess he's got to be careful of Esther. I guess she holds great power over him. So he does need to sort of tread a fine line here. I love the fact that we have the cats watching on again, just sort of coming back to the cats for no particular reason. But I like that, you know. And, you know, one of them saying, how were you ever captured by that kid? And he's like, well, the kid had a sardine. Uh-huh. You know, what was I supposed to do? And then, you know, you just had to go and tattle to the Cat King about it, you know, almost like trying to suck up to the king of the cats in the town.
Exactly.
You know, you're such a horse as one of the cats. I just love this. I mean, you know, in a sense, there's almost no need for the cats to be there in this episode. But I like that they can come back to them because it's a good little piece, I think.
It is. But I also feel like if this was a Neil Gaiman book, and he's written loads of great novels, I think if this was a Neil Gaiman book, you would see this threaded throughout the story, this idea that the Cat King has his cats all around the city and can spy on anybody, can follow everybody in the town because he's got these cats. And we know the cats can see the dead and alive people all across the town. So it's just putting that in there again. The Cat King is very powerful and has eyes everywhere, watching everything. So I think that's a nice little touch. Because again, in that conversation with Edwin and the Cat King earlier on, he was very much aware of what Edwin's been doing since the last time they met.
Definitely.
So it's a good little touch to have in there.
But I think on to our next moment, gone fishing, as they head off to go fishing for Angie, effectively, with this maritime music box that should hopefully put her to sleep. I mean, I love the fact that they have been trying to sort of attach pork scraps to it.
And
it's just kind of, they're just falling off. So how it will work. But as they head back towards the lighthouse, there is the night nurse at the top of the cliffs looking out to sea. And she, you know, she goes to Charles and Edwin, you two are errant, and I've come to put you in your assigned place in the afterlife.
Yes.
Which is really good.
Mm-hmm.
Crystal tries to sort of stop this from happening because Charles is adamant he doesn't want to leave. You know, he's got his friend in Edwin.
Mm-hmm.
Edwin certainly doesn't want to go back to hell, where he knows he will end up.
Absolutely.
So she tries to read the night nurse, but I love the fact she goes, you don't want to go there, love.
Absolutely.
It's too much for you.
Yeah. But it's kind of cool. I love when it leans into this side of things. It feels like at those kind of moments, it feels much more tied into the Sandman that we saw on Netflix. The Sandman dealt very well in the horror aspects of Neil Gaiman's type of world. And when we have these type of moments when Crystal is trying to read the mind of the night nurse, and we see the babies inside the skeleton, we see this absolutely horrible looking scene that instantly Crystal recoils from. She wasn't prepared for it, and the night nurse going, you will never be prepared to enter my mind, basically. So yeah. I thought that was really interesting. So, and again, to have a bit of horror in there along with all the other elements, it just adds to the show, I think.
That's it. And, yeah. I mean, Crystal effectively is taken out here and, you know, the Night Nurse focuses back on Charles and Edwin, and she's like, everyone has a place. And Charles is probably the most resistant to it. You know, he says, you know nothing about me.
Mm.
And then it takes the Night Nurse, brings us on this journey of the bullying and the beating by his dad, the bullying of his classmates as well, in his past life. And you know, you have here that Charles feels that I still have a purpose here. In a sense, he comes clean and says, I died too soon, you know, I don't want to be dead here after being shown all his past. And he gets very angry with the Night Nurse. He really is the one that steps up to challenge her position that you're just going to be assigned to the afterlife.
Absolutely. But you know, again, it's the connection to Edwin's past. You know, we saw how he was murdered by the other bullies in his school who treated him like a sacrifice. We don't get all of Charles's story here. No. We get flashes of it, but I guess my reading on it is he tried to defend someone else that was being bullied by his friends, is what the Night Nurse says, and they turned on him because he was trying to defend one of the other kids in the school. And I kind of feel, anyway, I guess we'll see a bit more of it hopefully later on in the season, but I feel like that's the connection with Charles and Edwin. He's trying to protect Edwin all the time. Charles is the muscle. Edwin's the brains. It feels like that's something that Charles has continued on with. He tried to protect someone that was weak from his friends who were bullying him, and they turned on him, and he eventually died of hypothermia. But we also have the flash to him being beaten by his father and him trying to stop it, saying he'll do anything that his father wants. And a really brutal response from the Night Nurse, who's in the scene with him at this time, going, but you can't make it any better. You can't do what he wants you to do. You didn't in life, and now you're dead, and that's the point. It's over. There's no more flashing back to this in your mind and trying to make your father happy anymore. You're dead and gone, and there's nothing more you can do about it. It felt really brutal from the Night Nurse.
Yeah, and the Night Nurse as well, you know, also says, anything is better than this place. Why are you still holding on to the mortal realm?
Exactly.
When you see how it treated you. Again, trying to do a riposte to Charles, who really says, you know, I still have a purpose. I want to be here. I don't want to be dead. But, you know, Charles gets so angry that effectively he is the one that starts using the music box, this metal music box, to sort of beat the Night Nurse around the head.
Yeah, absolutely. And then kicks her over the cliff into Angie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Solving two problems at once, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, but he's kind of expressing himself here so much, and ultimately defends Edwin here and manages to get the Night Nurse gulped up by Angie with the music box to help then tire out Angie.
Yeah.
So hopefully we see that the ghosts leave the lighthouse, and hopefully then that's the end of the leapers from the lighthouse.
Exactly, exactly. And that is the end, because we are on to our final point, case closed, as everything wraps up at the end of the episode. We have Tragic Mick, who, as you'd mentioned earlier on, had said he was trying to find a way to get in contact with the washerwoman. He's out trying to pick up some of the glass from around so that he can try and meet her. So he's following the directions that they had. They used the red glass to find her. He's trying to find a similar type of red glass so he can get in contact with her. We have Nico and Edwin sitting on bed watching Scooby-Doo, which I think is really cute, because obviously Dead Boy Detective's here. Edwin probably hasn't seen Scooby-Doo before. He's a big fan of those types of what were they called? Not the Famous Five, but those kind of investigation detective boys' own books.
Well, Edwin seems quite impressed with the investigative skills of the gang from Scooby-Doo, you know, so I like that. And Edwin's there saying as well, you know, that it was a top job today. I think, you know, yeah. Nice little connection there between him and Nico. Yeah. As she says as well, I also need to just sort of go through these letters finally from my mum.
Yes,
well.
She's never read any of them before. She's about to read one. But while the two of them are watching Scooby-Doo, the other kids are
well, they have a heart-to-heart, don't they, really, to Charles and Crystal?
Yes.
You know, Charles is like, I've been so angry for such a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I need something that's real, as he goes in for a kiss, with Crystal.
Yeah. And he doesn't feel the kiss, but it doesn't matter. As it goes to, closing credits for the episode, it goes on to be continued. But they have their kiss.
Yeah. Well, then just before that as well, you know, you have Edwin and Charles having a brief moment where Edwin says, you know, given how Charles expressed himself at the top of the cliff with the night nurse and the brutality which he kind of dispatched her, he just says, you know, you can talk to me about anything as well. Yes. So there's maybe a sort of a momentum shift here as this group of the dead boy detectives maybe can start to open up a bit more, which we see between Edwin and Nico a bit, at least for Nico, and also with Charles and Crystal.
Absolutely, absolutely. What do you think of this episode, John, as we get to the end?
I really enjoyed it. I would give this 4 Lords Are Leaping out of 5. It was a nice little investigation, and I like that the night nurse came in here. I like we got more, starting to sort of unravel Charles's story and Edwin again, starting to confront his feelings. And I think that was it for this, you know.
Yeah.
Crystal's always wanted to find out more, but the two lads of the dead boy detectives are starting to actually confront some of their pent up emotions that they've had for a very long time.
Absolutely. Here. Absolutely. It feels like, I'm sorry, I have loads of friends. I've got loads of male friends that I've known since I was 5 years old. And sometimes you just don't talk about your feelings with certain ones of those friends. And that's what it feels like Edwin and Charles' relationship has been like. They've been together for about 20 years at this stage, living in each other's pockets, running around doing detective stuff, and not once have they ever really talked about Charles's feelings and what happened to him or his dad and what he did to him. You know, it takes Crystal coming in and being the catalyst for those discussions. So, and the night nurse coming in and being a catalyst as well. But, there's some very good things about this episode. I think, I think the case rattled along pretty quick in the background, but the actual story of Edwin discovering his feelings for maybe Charles, maybe Monty, or just his general feelings of that maybe he's gay, that is a bigger part of this episode for me.
Absolutely.
And then learning Charles's history, learning how similar it is to Edwin's death in its own way, and the rage that he's feeling against his father. I think that's those two really interesting parts of the episode.
Definitely.
Great stuff. We're going to take a break, and we will be back with episode 5 of The Dead Boy Detectives.
She was so close to a meal with that juicy little Becky Aspen. I mean, to have it plucked away by those weaselly little detectives. She's just mommy's little slither bug.
That little slither bug is the size of a bus. I could afford to miss a few meals.
Darling, some people drink almond milk. Some people skip carbs. Some people feed their gigantic snake children to stay young and beautiful. It's honestly NBD.
Oh, I mean, you stood bleeding on the shore so that Lilith would come out of the ocean and grant you mortal life. She never said you had to stay young and beautiful.
Don't you dare mention that blood goddess's name!
She tricked me, Monty. What good is living forever if you're just going to wither away? So, I will feed my snake a generation of little girls to maintain my beauty. And those dead boys continue to get in my way. No one messes with Esther Finch. Is there something about that that's unclear to you, Monty?
Right, let's get on to our second episode of the podcast, on to episode 5, The Case of the Two Dead Dragons.
Indeed. Derek, what are some of the episode details here?
Well, this episode was written by Kelly Breslin and Jeremy Kaufman. Kelly was a writer on the TV show You, and this is Jeremy's first writing credit.
Good stuff.
Yeah. He's been an active writer for a long time. I think we've talked about this many times before, that lots of active writers don't get stuff produced, but he had loads of scripts out there, but this is the one that he gets the first writing credit on IMDb, so not a huge amount of information about him at the moment.
Good stuff.
Yeah. But the episode was directed by Amanda Tapping. She played Naomi in 10 episodes of Supernatural and directed 4 episodes of the show. She also directed episodes of The Flash, Batwoman, and Chilling Adventures of Sabrina as well.
Good stuff. Yeah. So definitely all the directors seem to be being tapped from the Greg Berlanti shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. But I suppose with The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, there's definitely some DNA in between those shows this one.
Yeah, exactly.
Aren't there?
Yeah. For sure, yeah.
Good stuff. John, do you want to tell us what they gave us with the Netflix synopsis for this episode?
Sure. While Crystal, Edwin, and Charles investigate the tragic murders of two popular athletes, Nico sets Jenny up on a date at the butcher shop.
Yes, she does.
She certainly does. Oof. I really, really enjoyed this episode for sort of everything around Jenny and her secret admirer as well. I just thought it played really, really well. And I'm so glad that Jenny, like, has this extra bit of exposure within the show here, something around her life as well.
Yeah.
Even though, again, it doesn't necessarily go as planned, but, yeah, I enjoyed this episode for that. I think, I mean, ultimately the investigation again takes place here, and it feels like it's almost an aside to again them talking about their, you know, what's bothering them. I think that's still very much at the forefront here in this episode.
Absolutely. We're learning more and more about these characters. We'll go into our top moments from the episode, but the one thing that struck me as I saw the plates come up with each of the top moments from the episode is that, you're right, the investigation seems to take a real backseat here, because our first point to start it off with is on Jenny's secret admirer. As Nico goes out and writes a letter to her mother, following on from last episode where she read the letter, she writes a letter to her mother, puts it into the postbox, and catches sight of one of those envelopes in the hands of Maxine from the library, who seems to be the secret admirer of Jenny.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then Nico takes it into her own hands to set up a date for Jenny.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I like also here in this point, you know, Nico effectively sort of excuses herself from the main investigation around the two dead dragons, these two athletes of Brad and Hunter, that come to ask for the help of the dead boy detectives, because she has a case of her own. I love that, again, just as an aside, we have the dandelion sprite being lovingly rude to Nico, as usual.
Yeah.
Like, Nico seems to really enjoy having them around, whereas you can sense that the, you know, Edwin and Charles think she should just be getting rid of them.
She tells the sprites themselves they need to be quiet because they're actively trying to kill her. All the rest of the friends are actively trying to kill her. But they are a fun little presence.
They are, absolutely.
I love just even when they're having that conversation outside about the two jocks that are dead, and there was a sad parade in town after they died. You hear just the voices of the two of them going, not as sad as your stupid face.
Yeah.
So, which, you know, again, it's just these little touches of these sprites that are there all the time listening in to everything that's going on, and they're very mean-spirited all the time, so I really like that.
And this leads us on to our next moment here, which is a nice little play on words in meet cute here.
Meet as in butcher shop.
Indeed. As Nico pimps out Jenny's shop all in pink with rose petals with, you know, fairy lights, you name it. Because she's persuaded Jenny to sort of just, you know, take the jump and meet her secret admirer. She's worked it with Maxine as well to come round to the butcher's shop. So I love the fact that she's setting up a date in the shop with all the meat still there and turning it with hearts and fairy lights and rose petals and candles.
Yeah.
And you name it.
I felt like Jenny would have run out of there in a second if it hadn't been her own butcher shop.
Yeah, well, exactly.
That's what it felt like. And you know, Nico making excuses, getting going, oh, just you have to go for it. You have to go full on. That's the way you do it in the first date. And as they sit and discuss and have their dinner in the butcher shop, you kind of hear that Maxine's quite obsessed with her.
Absolutely.
And interestingly, from the letters themselves, if you read some of the letters, the words that Maxine is using about Jenny are that she's her goddess, that she's watched her from afar all the time. And Jenny's been enjoying the letters because letters can't disappoint you. So she doesn't really want to meet Maxine, but is being pushed into it by Nico.
Absolutely. And I mean, in some ways, it seems to start off quite well in the, you know, Maxine also likes wine and murder documentaries as well as does Jenny.
Yeah.
I like that, you know, but they having this conversation, and Maxine, you know, this is the first hint of it, but Maxine manages to cover it up because Maxine talks about seeing Jenny at the fish market. Jenny's sort of giving out about the guys down at the fish market. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, how are you there? You know, I go there really early in the day. And she's just like, well, you know, I'm out for my early morning run. Mm-hmm. I saw you. And she's like, well, can you explain the concept of running to me? I really like that.
And speak slowly. Yes.
Yeah, and speak slowly. So, you know, there's hints here in these initial conversations that Maxine is effectively kind of, yes, is stalking her rather mm-hmm. than being a secret admirer. And this kind of builds as well as this date goes on. But Maxine and Jenny do kiss, but it then goes crazy as Maxine knows about Jenny's oversized pajamas mm-hmm. effectively that she wears to bed, and she's like, oh, it's just, if I happen to find myself in the alley outside the shop mm-hmm. and I look up, I can see you getting ready for bed mm-hmm. and I can sometimes see what you're actually watching, so I pull it up on, you know, and watch it along with you. You know, I have to fill in the blanks, like how your pillow smells. It's just like, it just really goes badly from there on out, really.
It does. Jenny instantly asks her to leave because she feels uncomfortable with how this conversation's going. It's getting really creepy, and I'm glad they did this, to be honest. Having these kind of stories is really important. We're two gay guys watching the show. These are LGBTQ stories. You know, it's always good to have that representation, but not everything is going to be a fairy tale story. And I'm glad this isn't in its own way. I'm sorry for Jenny as the character.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it feels like even when she has that first kiss with Jenny, she goes, it's been a very long time since I did this. She kind of keeps herself to herself. I think she talked about it with Nico, saying, I know every bachelorette in this small town, and all of them are just women with cats. Not my type of people.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So it's really sad that it went the way it went, but wow, does it go off the rails.
Well, she loses the plot considerably. Uh-huh. But she also, you know, broken wine glasses and all sorts. But mm-hmm. Maxine actually goes, I've got to clean things up again. And you're mm-hmm. like, okay, what does that mean? But she ends up with Jenny's meat cleaver in her hand as Jenny's hiding out in the back, at the back of the shop,
uh-huh.
With Maxine sort of effectively trying to find her, but ultimately it ends with her slipping on, I guess, a bit of blood or, I don't know, juice of some kind that's on the tiled floor. I was like taken aback because she gets impaled on the knife sharpener, mm-hmm. effectively that's clamped into the chopping block at the back of the butcher's. And yeah, so she's dead. I mean, this doesn't end well at all.
No,
and you have Crystal coming in going, oh my god, mm-hmm. Nico wondering why it's gone so badly. And the police are called, you know, as Maxine has been impaled on the knife sharpener.
Yeah. Because it just was so creepy as the conversation was going on, as Maxine was saying to her, you know, when I need to clear up, I need to clean everything up and get it all back to normal. It would have been great if you just hadn't talked. You know, it's so creepy. It's like, it is like a serial killer out of another Netflix show because they have hundreds of serial killer shows. And then to see her impaled at the end after what started out as being this pink and fluffy first date in the butcher shop. Yeah, ending the way it did. It's why the show's interesting to watch, right?
Absolutely.
It makes it completely different to what you expect going in, which I really like.
No, I like this little storyline in this episode.
Yeah.
You know, it was sufficiently dark enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of felt right that Maxine would be unhinged, really.
Yeah.
And you kind of got this. Jenny really should have gone with her initial thoughts about just not bothering to find the secret admirer, and Nico really, you know, is sorry that this has happened and probably should have stayed out of it. But
I think it's the unsaid part, and I kind of wish they'd said it a little bit, but the unsaid part of this is Nico's a teenage girl who has been, you know, effectively stuck inside her own room now with no friends. She's left school. She doesn't have much social interaction. But she's setting up an older woman like Jenny with somebody else without any experience of it herself. She just expects the world to be all hearts and flowers, expects everything to work out perfectly romantically, and that's just not the way of the world. Also, isn't hopefully the way of the world that someone will take out a meat cleaver on you if they don't like what you're saying to them, and you're saying you feel uncomfortable, and send them out, send them home. So, so hopefully it doesn't work out that way for everybody either. But that's kind of mainly Jenny's story and what happens with her in the episode, those first two points. Let's get on to our next one. The next title that comes up on the screen is What Marin Did, but let's talk about the whole case that goes on here with the two dead dragons.
Yes, the two jocks, Brad and Hunter, who basically come to the dead boy detectives going, we're pretty sure we were murdered. Yeah. They said it was alcohol poisoning, ultimately, but...
our eyes look, wouldn't be bloody like
yeah,
this.
Look at our eyes as there's blood coming out of the eyes, and... So they take the case again. They can get paid here.
Mm-hmm.
And the two dragons here are Brad and Hunter, because they were on the baseball team of the school, the Northport Townsend Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing they have really to go on is that the last thing they remember is a tree with, you know, twisted tree that seemed to have eyes.
Yes.
Ultimately, Crystal and the two lads in disguise go to the school to get info, pretending that they're journalists doing a follow-up piece on the death.
Yeah, they're not very good at the pretending to be journalists.
No, but weirdly, nothing really bad is really said about them on all the people that they interview and talk to.
Yeah.
But then we get a really nice moment with the school's mascot, who awkwardly is saying, well, you know, quick, psst, you know, get over here. Uh-huh. You need to go and chat to Twitchy Richie as well, which there's a nice moment here as they go to speak with Twitchy Richie. So he kind of explains how, you know, their mobile phones were never found, and that actually they were pretty bad and terrible to a number of girls, speaking of a girl called Shelby, who was Brad's girlfriend, and it was all very suspicious. But he obviously does, Twitchy Richie doesn't like them, and, you know, to get that information, I like how they do the whole ghost thing, because they've removed their disguise, so Twitchy Richie can't see them now, and you have the papers being flung up, the scissors walking across the counter, and then being pushed around by Charles to get this information from Twitchy Richie.
Well, again, it all kind of kicks off from... Crystal trying to use her powers to read his mind and sees it's just porn inside. Yeah. That's all that's in there in this teenage boy. But he's also an a-hole himself. That's the thing. Twitchy Richie is someone that doesn't like the two jocks. But, you know, the comments that he makes are clearly quite homophobic, and that doesn't go down well with Crystal or with the two guys. And he tries to threaten Crystal himself. So he's not a guy beyond reproach by any means here. So the minute he tries to turn on Crystal. I kind of love how it shows you what's happening, where he tries to intimidate her by lighting his Zippo lighter in front of her face, and the lighter keeps going out, and then it cuts to it's actually Edwin's hands putting out the lighter with his fingers as they start to taunt him, or haunt him, I suppose.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
I thought that was really good, but, you know, it's a nice setup there that he's not on the level, but he's giving them information that nobody else in the school is. Crystal commenting that, you know, there's no way that these two guys didn't have somebody that didn't like them. Everybody's saying just nice things about them, and they seem to be saying they're great guys. And we learn as the episode goes on that Charles really wants these two guys to be good guys, partly from what's happened in the last episode, where he got really angry and his anger spilled over into knocking the night nurse off the cliff, and that pushed Crystal away a bit. They have that conversation between them about everybody walking on eggshells now after that happened with Charles, when they saw his real anger come out. And he's saying in his own mind, he's talking to them saying he wants the two guys to be, you know, the nice kind of people, because he feels and he's worried that that could be him, as anger would overtake him.
And as the investigation goes on, you know, he's still trying to defend Brad and Hunter here. Mm-hmm. So they summon Shelby from the grave, or Edwin does. And we find out that she effectively was teased by Brad and Hunter. They dosed her with a drug. She was a good runner, and that kind of caused the end of her her running career at school. She was doing really well. You know, he wants them to be good guys.
But they said that after they caused the end of her career, she was dumped and told she was no longer interesting. So not only did she lose her career, she lost her boyfriend, lost all of her friends and the respect of everybody in the school that she had. And she took her own life.
And Crystal's there going, oh, okay, so, you know, they're not as good as we thought. Mm. As I say, Charles really trying to defend them because, you know, he's worried that he's a bad guy, you know, as well.
Yeah.
He's projecting himself onto these two, really.
Yeah, he is trying to defend them. And I suppose this is the challenge of being believed when something bad has happened to you, like what's happened to Shelby, the runner here. She's obviously tried to tell this story to other people, but everybody believes the jocks can't do anything wrong, right? You know? And Charles is kind of saying, well, there's just one person saying that it was their fault. Can't possibly be these two good guys, you know, that everybody loved in the school. You know, we've got hundreds of people saying that they're stand-up guys and just one person saying that they're wrong. And that really gets Crystal's back up. She gets really irritated with this idea that he's not believing in what Shelby's saying. Shelby killed herself after what they'd done to her, you know?
Yeah.
Even if it is only one person that they've done that to, she should be believed. Clearly, she's had that bad experience. There is a great moment when the two of them interrupt the conversation that Edwin's having with Shelby after she's died, where she just turns around like something out of Ghostbusters and screams at the two other ghosts that have walked up. Just,
you know, draws out a real vicious response. Mm-hmm. I mean, she apologizes afterwards, but it was really good. And then they get another call here from Maren, who was Hunter's girlfriend.
Yeah, they do. They do.
You know?
Yeah. And one of the little thing I wanted to point out, I guess, in the kind of bigger scheme of things in Sandman, we talked about it before, that what happens after death is a personal experience for everybody in the universe of Sandman. So people that go to hell because they believe in hell and believe actually that's where they're supposed to be going. For the most part in Sandman, some people are punished and obviously put in hell. Some people go to heaven because they believe in heaven. Some people get reincarnated because that's what they believe. And here with Shelby, she killed herself. And what they explain is that often people who've died by suicide walk the earth for the rest of their lives because they haven't finished their lives out. They haven't completed the lives they should have had. So we hear from Shelby, she absolutely regrets taking her own life because she now can't experience anything more, and she's punishing herself by walking the earth.
Yeah,
which I thought was an interesting nod to that mythology again of the Sandman about people do tend to punish themselves more than anybody else would punish them.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
But we end off going to Maren's house there after she's called.
Yeah.
And where she basically says that she lied, and we get the sense here of another person speaking badly of Brad and Hunter. And she says that she thinks it was Twitchy Richie who actually killed them. Because again, the you know, Brad and Hunter got him hooked on Adderall and then selling him Molly. Nice little joke. We need to investigate Molly next from Edwin, who doesn't understand the slang term.
Uh-huh.
And you know, but when he realizes it's the drug side of it, it's like, oh, that connects with Shelby. Yeah. But we see Maren acting quite nervous and strange as she invites Crystal in to go through it further, offering her a gin, which looks kind of strange. But Edwin and Charles go to investigate the house to see if there's any more information that they can get. Charles notices there's no actual pictures of Hunter, despite being her boyfriend. And then they find a little compartment behind one of the sideboards in her room where they find the two phones.
Exactly. And they see the tree outside with the with what looks like eyes and hands.
Yeah, that was really cool, actually. Yeah. I like the kind of look of that.
It was very cool.
Don't know whether there was CGI involved in that. I'm sure there was, but it looked really cool.
Yeah, it did. It did. So we find out what actually happened was when we get the story from Maren was that she'd sent some photographs of herself to her boyfriend at the time, Hunter, who'd shared it with Brad and then was saying to share it that he was going to share it with the rest of the team. And just says that the absolutely disgusting phrase of, well, you sent them to me, they're mine now, so I get to do with them what I want if you didn't want them shared, you shouldn't have sent them to me.
And she actually just wanted to knock them out so she could take their phones, but ends up poisoning their drinks instead. And brings in Twitchy Rich to dispose of the bodies because she knew he hated them.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting that she tried to blame him, though, as he was the accomplice. Like, he'd throw it off on somebody else, I guess.
You would think so.
But she's not a criminal mastermind. You know, the fact that the two guys died rather than her knocking them out, that was an accident. But she does go down the path of trying to do the same thing to Crystal. Now, knowing what happened to the two guys, she tries to kill Crystal and realizes her error here, or how far she was willing to go when they stop her, and then turns herself into the police. So
I mean,
at least taking responsibility.
The other interesting thing that comes from this is that, you know, Crystal suddenly goes, it's strange the things that actually we have in common in terms of her, Charles, and Edwin, is that our lives have been changed by shitty boys that went too far. And it's what Brad and Hunter did with Maren, but also what Maren did to them.
Yeah.
What's happened here with the boys from the boarding school, with Edwin, the boys at the same school as Charles, and also then with Dave the Demon, with Crystal. And we have here, you know, a lot of that connection with Dave the Demon in this episode as well. But the case is closed.
Yep. As usual, our next point for the episode, case closed. And the case is closed, everything solved, we know who the murderer is, and now that means that Hunter and Brad can now go on to their next phase, I guess, the next place. And the two of them, kind of looking at Edwin and Charles, are saying to them, you know, we are better than everybody else. We should have been going on to college. Yeah. Everybody here worships us. We are better than everybody else. And instantly there, I think, Charles realizes how bad they really are, how bad these two guys are, what they've done. When he learned the story of what they'd done to Maren, he realized they are
They're bullies. They're the classic bullies.
But more so, it's the fact that they believe they are better than everybody else, which gives them the right to do the things that they were doing, you know? And they get their true comeuppance. You know, again, we don't get to see death in this episode, but death comes to take them in the form of a demon coming from hell and dragging them to hell, the place they deserve to go for the things they've done to Maren and to Shelby.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
And we have, you know, Charles saying then, you know, he wanted them to be good guys, but because he kind of was projecting himself onto them in a sense.
Exactly.
Which I thought was really good, you know, and, you know, Edwin kind of steps in here and says, you know, you're not a bad person.
Exactly.
You're not a bad guy like they are.
Yeah.
Bad guys normally don't ask themselves or question whether they're bad guys.
Exactly.
Because I've been in hell for 70 years. I know about bad guys.
I know about
them. You know, you are one of the good guys here, you know?
You're the best person I know.
Yeah.
And then they hug. And there's a little moment where Edwin is definitely a bit taken aback by the hug.
Absolutely.
From Charles, but reciprocates.
Again, linking into the previous episodes, really, and those kind of thoughts and the beginnings of those thoughts that the Cat King has released, and Nico had kind of furthered, you know?
Exactly. let's close out with Girls' Night, the last moment of the episode. We have Nico, Jenny, and Crystal sitting outside on the curb. Nico really apologetic for what's happened. With Crystal, they go and talk to the cops about kind of filling in the info about what happened with the death of Jenny's secret admirer inside. And David again grabs Crystal at this point.
He keeps showing up in her thoughts, really.
Yeah, we saw it right at the start of the episode. He appeared in her thoughts appeared in her nightmares, and now he's jumped into her mind once again at this point. It's like as if when she's thinking about something else, in he jumps, you know, and trying to mess up who she is. But she tries to push him away after everything she's seen in the investigation of these two jocks. She tries to push him away, saying, I'm not going to have my whole life screwed up just because of a boy, just what happened to Shelby and what happened to Maren. And he's pushing back to her, going, I'm not a boy here. I'm a demon, and I get exactly what I want whenever I want it, basically. And she awakes with Charles at the curb again after this shouting, I guess, from David. And she has no idea how she's going to stop him, how she's going to block him and keep him out of her mind. It's an interesting kind of flip back to the start of the episode, where her seeing David in her dreams is connecting with the violence or the anger that she saw in Charles. And again, it's why she's pushing him away. We heard her at the start going, she has to work through all of these issues with David. She has to work through everything that's going on with her family. So she wants to go back to being friends with Charles after that kiss they had last episode, but partially. And that's not what that's the thing she hasn't told Charles, is that in her mind, she's starting to connect, you know, the abusive boyfriend that she had in David the Demon. She's starting to connect that a little bit with Charles. You know, could she be wrong about him because she's seen the violence of him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We also have a moment here between Edwin and Monty. Mm-hmm. Monty's kind of been pushy and has taken him on an evening walk.
Yes.
And have Edwin kind of opening up here, you know, thinking, well, at least to some extent, you know, whilst he thinks they should stop seeing each other, he kind of says, you know, ultimately I'm afraid of my own feelings. It's difficult to deal with these new feelings around relationships and connections that he's got, and particularly with Charles. But we have...
Well, that's not what he says at Monty. He completely obscures the person that he's talking about.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But it is about Charles, because we have Monty swinging in for a kiss, and he says, well, I have feelings about you too. And Edwin says, I wasn't talking about you.
Oops.
You know? And it's like poor Monty's kind of left on the swing in the moonlight after sort of taking a gamble. The whole conversation, the opening up about his feelings and how difficult he has with dealing with them, is actually not about his feelings towards Monty.
Exactly. Poor Monty. So we kind of got earlier on in the episode when he was talking to Esther as she was working out, you know, the plan to get back at Edwin for what he did. You kind of get that feeling properly from Monty that he's starting to get a bit sweet on Edwin. He's starting to like Edwin a lot. We also learn a lot more about what's going on with Esther, that she's feeding her massive snake in the basement to keep her young, because Lilith cursed her with eternal life. We talked a little bit about Lilith last episode, but Lilith...
But it was the eternal life was still that she could... wither.
She would grow older and older and older forever, for all eternity. But it seems like Esther's found a loophole that she can feed young girls to the snake. I love that line from her. It just suddenly had a bit of a flip of evil to her, because she's been a very fun presence in the show, really, since we saw her in the first episode. But just that flip of evil in her, saying that she will take an entire generation of young girls and stay young. She doesn't care.
You can see the whole Lilith thing rankles with her, for sure. Absolutely. And I mean, she does question Monty, you know, are you trying hard enough here? Mm-hmm. Because the plan is kind of nearing fruition, and we see her revenge kit that she got from Tragic Mix.
Yes.
At least the mushroom looks much bigger, so whatever that's about will be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anything else? Any other notes from the episode that we haven't talked about, John?
No, none from me.
Just one tiny note from me. Just the harbinger, I guess, that Nico's plan wasn't going to go very well of having Jenny's secret admirer come in for the dinner date with her in the butcher shop. She used the magic eight ball that they got last week, or last episode, from the ghost that was haunting the lighthouse, the magic eight ball that tells people when they're going to die in the future. It doesn't tell Nico that, but what it does do, it says the outlook's not so good as she's talking about the date. So yeah, the magic eight ball, I guess, was telling her things are not going to go well today, exactly, with this date. So I like that little touch of a harbinger, yeah, that it's going to go badly. I don't think even if she had taken it, she would have thought the date would go as badly as it did.
No, absolutely. Yeah. There is actually one thing. We have Edwin, who's kind of got the book that Monty gave him on the astrology charts. And he says, you know, he just makes a comment around Aries and Taurus are not really very compatible with one another. Whether that's him talking about himself and Monty, or himself and Charles, or maybe Charles and Crystal, I don't know.
Yeah, he's definitely looking it up for a reason.
Yeah, he's looking up for a reason.
I wonder if we look back at that episode when Monty met Nico and Edwin at the start and told them what their birth signs were. Maybe there was something in that that we could work it out. Yeah, that's good little catch there, John. Great stuff. Overall, John, what did you think of this episode?
I'd give this 3.5 roadkill faces out of 5.
That was the joke for the sprites. That's what it was. Yes, not as sad as your roadkill face. Yes.
No, I enjoyed it, particularly around Jenny.
Yes.
I guess in some ways the case of the two dragons I was less invested in for sure. But I think, you know, the whole through storylines of Crystal and David the Demon, but also the connections within the dead boy detectives. I'm really enjoying.
Yeah,
so yeah.
Yeah.
3.5 rose kill faces out of 5 for me.
Yeah, my only big detractor for this episode, I liked it, but my only big detractor honestly was the titles that were coming on screen, because if you're going to use that as your mechanic for all your episodes, make sure you're picking titles that explain what's happening in the scenes. It just, some of them seem completely out of sync with what was going on in the episode. So I thought that, like, this I think 2 titles appear in a minute on the screen here. So get your titles right.
Yeah.
Maybe they came up with that after they'd written the episode. Maybe that was the way they did it. So it just seemed a bit odd. But overall, loving these characters, really enjoying spending time with them.
Enjoying them.
And sometimes the cases just drop into the background a bit. Sometimes there's some really interesting stuff that's going on in the case, but I felt like there was more to do with Jenny and more to do with Edwin and Charles than the actual case this time. So so that was an interesting way of doing it. But yeah, I'm excited to see more of these characters.
I'm really enjoying the characters, and I love the story. I like the tone of these episodes. Mm-hmm. I think there's a darkness, there's a lightness, there's a quirkiness to them, and I'm enjoying that. And I enjoy this group of 4 of Charles and Edwin, but with Crystal and Nico, almost as the complications. As I said before, I think the side characters of Jenny, Monty, and Esther really good as well, great. And the Cat King,
and the Nightmares,
and just having as well then just the crazy little sprites or the cats coming in giving a quick commentary. Generally, a ruse commentary is really good fun.
Absolutely. Great stuff. Let's see what our fellow dreamers had to say. Let's go over to some feedback from our wonderful fellow dreamers. If you want to send any of your thoughts, of course, you can email us to feedback@tvpodcastindustries.com, or again, join us on our Facebook group where there's a spoiler post up for each of the episodes of Dead Boy Detectives on facebook.com/groups/tvpodcastindustries. First up, we got a message in on Facebook from Dr. Bob on episode 4, who says the open-eyed anime existence of Nico wandering through the world and taking the bites she wants gives the ideal yang to the yin and repressed and slightly bitter Edwardian boy. Aggie was an excellent monster of the week and has ruined my preconceived notions of the Night Nurse arc. Good to see Charlie putting his ghostly energies into assisting the heartbroken medium, but we're still left with Whistledown chasing after the tattooed mystery of Jenny. Who is it with the typewriter? The cute librarian? Not Walrus Man? Really enjoying this episode.
Excellent stuff, Dr. Bob. Yeah. No, absolutely.
He guessed it was the librarian.
Yeah. And I guess what happens to the Night Nurse. Yeah, we didn't really kind of pick up on that, but seemingly she's been turned into a meal for Angie, the anglerfish. You know, has she survived that? What is going to happen there?
Exactly. Good stuff. Thanks, Dr. Bob.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Bob. Laura Willie-Swink says, really enjoying the show, especially this latest episode where we see Edwin beginning to open up his emotions and his sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I do love how Nico is gently supporting him through this discovery. Mm. Though I like all the characters so far, this friend dynamic is my favourite at this point.
Very good.
This show definitely aims for a younger demographic than Sandman, mm-hmm. and maybe even Good Omens. However, it still feels like the same game and universe. The fact that my 17-year-old, my constant game and watch partner, pointed out that the female Dandelion Pixie is TikTok famous really proves the point. But Dead Boys still features all the hallmarks of Gaiman's imagination. Mm-hmm. Traditional and sometimes obscure mythology and lore mixed with the author's quirky imagination and modern sensibilities.
Mm.
I do have one niggling issue with the show, which I will excuse because it's needed in order for the show to actually work. But there is a whole organization to deal with the dead who have gone missing.
Mm.
Does this infer that Death is not doing her job to the best of her abilities? What? She would never.
Interesting point, Lara. All I'm going to say is that there is a reason in the comic books that I don't think they're going to explore in the Dead Boy Detectives, but we think might be happening in Sandman Season 2.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, but they may have to explain it, I suppose. So, pure speculation on my part, I think Death may have allowed Edwin and Charles stay on Earth for longer. That's my feeling. There may have been some conversation with her where she's allowed them to stay here and do what they're doing. Because you're right that, you know, Death knows where everybody is.
Yeah.
Death comes for us all, as the phrase goes. So, so if she hasn't made a deal with them, there's something happening here, that's allowing them to stay on Earth for as long as they can.
Or she's allowing them to do what they're doing without having told them, because they do think that she's after them. They go that's and true. Hide. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly. So maybe
like you saw in this one, they get inside Charles's, infinite micro universe in his bag.
Exactly. So I wonder if we'll learn a bit more as to why they're on Earth. But you're right, there is an entire department dedicated to the missing children, the children that weren't able to be brought to their final resting place. That's part of the show. Just the reason why I say it may be something they explain later on, or maybe connected to Sandman, was just that one line that said they're also completely overloaded with casework as well. So something is happening, something that we may not see in the show here, but I feel like you're right. They do need a bit of an explanation for that one.
Definitely. Yeah. Thanks, Laura, for the feedback. Heather Wallace says, I love Nico so much. She lights up the screen when she appears. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just a great, great character. Excellent stuff.
A real bright spot, I think. And I love that it counters to what Jenny is, you know, this sort of darker goth-like creature.
Exactly, and she works well with the sprites because they're also really dark and saying things that she would never say. And as Lara said as well, just her connection with Edwin is really, really fun to watch and the episodes. Great stuff. We got an email in from Coffee and Vodka on episodes 4 and 5. He says, greetings, fellow Dunked Defenders. If the first 3 episodes were set up, the fourth slammed them well home. This has gone from a weird creative compromise to a show that's now its own animal. Now invested and hoping for another season, from the typewritten admiration note to the lullaby held by the night nurse and digested by Angie, this week was fantastic. Episode 5 established my favourite character of the show. Jenny is awesome and very much relatable. It's also the first time I've ever seen anyone turn a meat cleaver into a sexy fashion accessory. All that happened in this episode, easily the standout, was her once promising no good, very bad dinner date. Both humorous and tragic, it showed, along with Charlie's rock-throwing tormentors and popular toxic jocks, that people make for some of the worst demons ever. 5 red crystal revelations, twitchy richy reactions, and meat cutes out of 5. Peace and take care, Coffee and Vodka.
Great stuff, Coffee and Vodka. Mm. Yeah, totally with you on Jenny. Really, really awesome. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right that the worst demons are the humans.
Often, yeah.
They're really mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's easy to assign in a story that the evil of the world is a demon. But, you know, we've seen it in Sandman. We've seen it in some of the other characters that are in this universe. There are people that will be encouraged by demons, but the badness comes out of humanity very often. And, you know, that's what's caused a lot of the problems here. You know, that that line from Crystal saying that all of us are here, the connection that we have between all of us is boys going too far.
Yep.
Boys will be boys. Boys will be allowed to do anything. And what happens to them? All of them are in this horrible situation because of humans. So, yeah.
Really glad you're enjoying it as well. Coffee and vodka.
Absolutely.
Like myself. Mm-hmm. So good stuff. Keep the thoughts coming in. Mm-hmm. Back to Facebook. Paul Tien Shi Lee for episode 4 and 5 says, the show very nicely balances plots from individual episodes with character changes in later episodes. Mm-hmm. Charles getting stuck in the Devlin house loop brings back his family trauma, which was further reactivated by Night Nurse, mm-hmm. and then finally opened up to Crystal and Edwin by the end of Dead Dragons. Great storytelling and show running. Mm-hmm. I doubt I'll be the first to bring this up. The show is pretty dang queer, and I'm glad the writers are handling that well. Mm-hmm. My quick read of the summary from the two limited comic runs suggests that Edwin reveals his feelings for Charles to Charles. It looks like the show is following suit, so we'll see how that works out. And a general comment about fictional Port Townsend, borrowing a line from South Park, this is pretty messed up right here. Mm-hmm. Given the number of deaths, not to mention the number of severed feet, there'll be a ton of real crime podcasters swarming the place. Keep up the great podcast work. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, not if Jenny gets to them first.
Yeah,
she
exactly.
doesn't like crime podcasters at all.
Not at all. Absolutely, yeah. The number of deaths happening in this little town, it would be a magnet for real crime podcasts.
It would.
And detectives. I mean, even just with the Lighthouse Leapers, you know, Charles is kind of saying we don't normally involve humans in on the cases because they never believe it.
Exactly.
So I guess maybe there's that element to it.
Yeah, like didn't the cops who were interviewing Nico and Crystal thought they were on drugs for the their explanation
and
of
shouldn't
what was
they
going
be
on.
In school? I like that kind of running gag as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like the focus on LGBTQ characters in the show as well, as you brought up, Paul. I suppose the interesting part is there are loads of straight characters in the show as well. We've met loads of them. We've met the jocks. We've met all the kids in the school now as they were being interviewed in this second episode. There's loads of characters there, but they're focusing on Edwin and Charles, and they're focusing on Edwin's thoughts about Charles. And, you know, they're, of course, are going to have more storylines that would deal with that. And they're handling it really well. It is being written really well because these are the characters that you're around. They're all the Fend family, I suppose. So they are going to have connections with each other. But you're right. The way that they're playing the long game with some of the storylines, things happening in episode 3 and paying off in episode 5 is also working really well for me in the show. Great stuff. Thanks so much for that, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
And finally, Dr. Bob Phillips says, flailing with so much unrestrained joy, I think I might be transmuting into a bearded bold Nico. The choices to abbreviate with a properly balanced filleting knife the sexy femme librarian psycho murdering stalker storyline into 3 scenes was unexpectedly fantastic.
Absolutely.
The unfurling and discovery of the richness of Edwin's feeling alongside the loving rebuilding of a traumatized Charles is heart-achingly good, and the direct arrival of the Octopus of Satan bypassing the need for Death to have their softer conversations put a hard stop on that line. I'm reading this as Death offering the heavenly ways forward, but will be swayed by what else we see. Great stuff, Dr. Bob. Yeah, I kind of mentioned about, you know, the potential for what happens in the afterlife being connected to the actual people themselves.
Yeah.
And here, I would say that's these boys are being sent straight to hell for everything they've done and for everything that's been found out by the dead boy detectives here. And it kind of, you know, I suppose that kind of connects into what I was trying to say in response to Lara's thoughts about where Death is. Potentially maybe some deal is being made by someone here to keep them on Earth because they're doing the investigation. Remember, they've got that postman that keeps delivering them cases and keeps delivering letters to them. So maybe somebody is behind a bit of that and wants them to do the investigations they're doing to find out what happened here to some of the spirits and some of the people in this town. So
to deal with some of the backlog that's happening with the...
Potentially.
You know, for the Night Nurse.
Yeah, potentially, that's it.
And so, the afterlife department, I guess. Yeah.
So it might be something that'll come out as the episodes go on.
Yeah, great stuff, Dr. Bob. Mm-hmm. Completely agree with your thoughts about this show.
Yeah.
Really great stuff.
Yeah, been a lot of fun. And that's it for our chat about episodes 4 and 5, The Dead Boy Detectives. 3 more episodes to go. Next time we'll be back discussing The Dead Boy Detectives episode 6, The Case of the Creeping Forest.
Yes, and of course, episode 7, The Case of the Very Long Stairway.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us for this episode. Hopefully you'll be joining us for those 2 episodes next week. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, why not share it with your friends? Because sharing the podcast is
sharing the love. Absolutely. Yeah, thank you so much, fellow dreamers, for joining us for these 2 episodes of The Dead Boy Detectives. Until next time, of course, keep watching, keep listening, and of course, keep dreaming.
Bye.
Bye.